Welcome to another edition of Expanding Mind. I'm your host, Eric Davis, unpacking the cultures of consciousness. One of the routes, of course, to exploring consciousness is through music. It's one of the ways that I think most of us, so, or ordinary folks as well as intrepid psychonauts, explore their emotions, their imaginations, the way in which culture can transform the ordinary world into a place of the sublime, the terrifying, the fascinating, and the groovy. And for me, one of the mainstays of this kind of musical exploration has been electronic music, and particularly a kind of zone of electronic music that was born or really reborn in the early 90s, kind of as a response to the intensity of rave music and the need for a sort of quieter side of the electronic experience. And so the chill-out space was born in the rise of ambient music. And though, of course, there's predecessors in the 70s and 60s and even earlier times, it's really that moment in the 1990s that birthed the music that was really explicitly designed to kind of open up the heart, to provide a sort of alternative zone of drifting delights, and yet to kind of explore cognitive realms as well. Sort of partly in response to that, there was the emergence of the unfortunately named genre of intelligent dance music, which has all sorts of problems which we don't need to go into because it's all old history at this point. But it basically signified people who were trying to use the same kinds of tools and techniques that people were using on the dance floor to provide other kinds of music for other sorts of spaces and other sorts of lives, not just ambient music, but all sorts of explorations of rhythm and timbre. And I listen to tons of this stuff, and I continue to listen to electronic music as it's gone through all sorts of changes. We don't need to talk about all the various dance genres that have come and gone and come back and gone again and come back yet again. But for me, I still remain interested in the sort of trippier, less beat-driven, more multidimensional spaces that can be opened up by electronic music. And I'm very, very happy today that we have Evan Bartholomew on the show, a.k.a. Blue Tech, who for me has managed to, at the same time, keep alive and preserve a lot of what I've loved about electronic music over the last couple decades, but also continuing to change and transform and bring his wide variety of musical styles, tastes, and alternate identities to bear on the music he's making, as well as to take a lot of the feelings and hopes and dreams associated with this kind of music, ideas of expanded consciousness, of integration with nature, of spiritual discovery, and actually bring that to bear on his actions in the world, and taking it out of the purely musical zone into activism and a variety of very interesting projects that I'm looking forward to talking to him about. We're not going to have Maja today, so we'll just move right on and welcome Evan to the show. Evan, thanks so much for joining us on Expanding Mind.
Awesome. Thanks for having me, Eric.
Yeah, it's really good. So I got to start out because I always like to find out like where people are, and I think you're calling from Hawaii. I know you've gone back and forth to living on Hawaii off and on, and I'd love to hear sort of how you wound up there again and what you're building out there, because I hear it sounds like a pretty excellent zone for a somewhat hermit-like musician like yourself, who loves to be close to the land.
My last mainland move was a very, very short one. I think I lasted about 10 months in Portland, and the constant gray just got me down. I couldn't imagine being anywhere else other than Hawaii, so I moved back and made this permanent home for me.
You're on the Big Island?
I'm on the Big Island, yep.
Sweet. And so in some of the materials, they said you're constructing a solar-powered studio. It sounds like you're not just you know, rooting yourself in the place, but really trying to get in touch with the land and the local trees and trying to make your own environment kind of reflect that zone.
Yeah, I actually bought 3 acres here, and we're very, very close to finishing house and studio, which is 100% off-grid, solar-powered, built with trees that we harvested from the land and trying to turn into a kind of retreat botanical estate, planting hundreds and hundreds of trees and bamboo and medicine plants and flowers and all kinds of stuff.
That's just wonderful. I mean, how do you kind of experience the balance between, you know, this wonderful sort of opportunity to really, you know, root in the physical environment and to construct a balanced way of living in this environment with your continued musical work? I mean, are you sort of achieving this sort of really interesting balance? Is there some kind of tension between the, you know, got to go into the studio and make my music, kind of want to go out and plant in my garden? How do you balance those?
It's a constant challenge, actually. The balance is often elusive. The creative process, I find, goes hand in hand with, you know, the tending of the land. It's all kind of part of the same expression. I can be in the studio working on music, take a walk through the garden, plant something new, check on things, start seeds. That all kind of feels organic. It's the kind of the disparity between this groovy organic life in Hawaii and having to get on a plane and do, you know, 9 cities in 10 days, that is the big challenge.
Yeah, yeah. I remember something similar was true for Terrence McKenna, who also lived on the Big Island, and I remember visiting him there, and he was, you know, I really kind of got to see his life. You know, from the outside, it looked like this kind of groovy life of, you know, cruising around all these fascinating places, and then he was illuminating the kind of rigors of the road and how much he really dreamed of creating some kind of, you know, virtual way of doing his lectures so that he could avoid the plane rides and the hotels and the constant moving. But at least you have such a, you know, wonderful place to go back to. But I'm curious, did you always have sort of a, let's say, a green thumb or an interest in sort of building and inhabiting your environment, or was this something that you kind of developed or even cultivated, you know, as you were when you were older?
It really kind of sprang out of a response to being in Hawaii, getting out of the chaotic flow of the city and all the noise and, you know, compacted energy, and being in a place that moves differently, where you wake up with the sun and you fall asleep to frogs and you don't hear cars and helicopters and electronic signals. Like, for me, the only possible response was to become fascinated by and to fall in love with the natural world and kind of engage in cultivating a botanical reality here as a response to the sense of peace and the relaxation that was happening from being in an environment like this.
Wow, you know, I got to say, I have a totally contradictory response to what you just said, which is, you know, on the one hand, I find it totally inspiring, not only because, you know, because I sort of idealize a life like that often. I kind of dream of it. I'm a city guy. I've always been a city guy. There's a lot of reasons to keep me in the city. And so on the one hand, I'm like, wow, yeah, you can still change, whatever. And now, but it's also more difficult because I don't think of myself as someone who's capable of, like, really getting into the land in the way that I know other people do, like yourself. But what you're reminding me is that, you know, part of these responses have to do with just actually being in these places. It's not like I'm, you know, like, I think a lot of people in the city, well, I don't know how to do any of this stuff, you know, I'm just a city guy, blah, blah, blah. You get out there, and then, you know, if you fall in love, if you can listen to the trees, and I certainly love listening to the trees and the frogs and all that, then, you know, who knows what kind of change, you know, can come. So I'm sitting here going, like, man, this could happen to me, too.
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't have to be a all-or-nothing scenario. You know, our social lives have become increasingly digital, so it's not like I'm disconnected from the pace of the city and what people are doing, and I definitely get my urban experience packed in into these really short time frames. So for me, it's kind of the necessary antidote to being blistered by too much input when I'm on tour. Like, for me, the only way of functioning and finding that balance is to kind of pursue the opposite when I'm not on the road.
Yeah, that's great. Well, I'm really happy for you that it sounds like it's really really rolling. I'm also curious, like, whether in some ways your music led you to this. I mean, it's always kind of an easy and also sort of a danger to project too much on a musician's music in terms of, you know, understand, oh, this is what they're going through, or this is what it means for them, because it means so many different things to so many different people. But even though you've almost, you know, exclusively dealt with electronic instruments, pulling music out of circuits and out of, you know, sequencers and drum machines and out of the electric grid inside of devices, that there's always been a kind of organic thread and feel to your music. It's a lot of what people responded to. You know, I remember your earliest recordings, they came out, they had this kind of special glow to them, and they really meant a lot to people because they heard something in there that I think you've allowed a lot of other people to explore, you know, partly by way of example. But there's always been this kind of interesting organic tension there, and I'm like, but then it's sort of funny because you're making kind of organic music with these instruments that can seem, at least from the outside, to be sort of, you know, antithetical to the kind of, you know, vibe of a whatever, like a viola, or, you know, a goat skin covered drum or something like that. So how have you found your way to the organic through electronics, or through your music, through engaging machines in a certain way? Or is it more of like a contrast with the garden and the trees?
I don't really see it so much as a contrast. I think at its very best, the music is an expression of soul. And for me, kind of pursuing that melodic narrative, whether it's a viola or a Moog synthesizer, has always been kind of paramount. Expressing an emotional concept through a listenable space. And for me, it doesn't really matter. I can sit down at the piano, or I can sit down and program on the computer. They're both tools, and if I'm doing my job effectively, then I'm letting a little bit of soul come out through that process. So I never really saw it as a juxtaposition or a forced marriage between opposite ideals. It's always just been a tool for me. It's a tool.
Is that partly because melody is so, you know, important to your music? I mean, I think that's one of the things that stands out to me is a certain complexity to the melody it's more song like without being a song. There's some kind of emotional charge to it. Is that part of the way that, in a way, it doesn't really matter whether it's a viola or a synthesizer, because there's the soul is in part in the melody?
Yeah, I mean, like, my background is classical, and when I started my career, there was definitely a novelty factor to bringing a really melodic sensibility. These days, I mean, the line between electronic musician and modern classical composer is really, really blurred. When you look at Erase Tapes and Niels Fromm and these, you know, Alofer Arnold, these records that are coming out, 10 years ago, I would have called it electronic ambient music. Now it's called modern classical. Like, there's not so much of a distinction anymore. It's really just about, in an increasingly digitized reality, it is about the tool. Anything can be an instrument.
Yeah,
MacBook Pro doesn't really matter to me. They're tools to be used.
Well, it's funny, even in if you look at, like, traditional old school classical recordings, you know, if you get a studio recording of a, you know, symphony or whatever, someone doing Brahms string quartets or whatever, if you actually look at the technological practice that goes behind that, what happens in the studio, it's incredibly digital. It's all cut. It's about cuts and splices and tiny little micro massagings, and I mean, it's all digital. You know, at this point, you know, very much. Well, I mean, you've been making this music for a long time, you know, and you've been, from the beginning, you had a distinct voice. You know, it's not like you had to work through many, many releases before you sort of found your voice, at least to my ear. You started off in the music that we were hearing, already had a distinct kind of Blue Tech vibe. So how has it been like to sort of, you know, grow over this time with your own distinct voice, with your own desires to bring in the quality of soul to the music, but, you know, as the scene around you, as what electronic music is. All these things have been changing. Like, how have you sort of, you know, found your own way to grow through all the changes that have happened over the last, whatever, you know, 15 years?
I made a very decided practice early on not to pay too much attention to the sound du jour. I realized that the second I tried to emulate what was happening, you know, whatever new genre, whatever new particular micro subgenre of a subgenre based in one particular region was happening, the second I aligned myself to that, then the music instantly became dated. So I've kind of just cultivated a not an unawareness of what's happening, but I cultivate an unawareness in the studio of what's happening and really try to pursue what I'm feeling in the moment rather than writing music as a response to what other people are doing. I really don't want to be regional, and I don't want to be dated, you know?
Yeah, so that makes a lot of sense.
Lost the magic somehow by trying to make the music that they thought people wanted, and I realized very early on that was a path to destruction, and that for me, the only reason to keep doing it is if I'm challenging myself to express myself in a more clear way. And I figured, you know, the people that follow me down the rabbit hole are true fans, and they don't want me to make a dubstep record. They don't want me to try to copy whatever else is happening. They just want to hear me continue to explore and evolve personally as an artist.
Well, talk a little bit about how you've been able to maintain that conviction, in the sense that, has it been easy? Has it been difficult? Because I can only imagine that, you know, it's obviously it's challenging to, you know, make your living off of being a musician. It's particularly challenging in an environment like electronic music, where there's such a sense of trend, and particularly over the last few years with this explosion of EDM, and then you have, you know, people who are helping you out, and da-da-da-da. There's going to be some kind of pressure on one level or another to, you know, find your own variation, but to some extent to, like, get a little bit more plugged into the way the ball is moving. And obviously you haven't, I mean, you know, you dabbled in that direction, as you said, but you haven't done that. How difficult is that? And what sort of resources do you need to pull from in yourself or in your community that enable you to do that? Because I think there's other musicians out there who wrestle, lots of people wrestle with the same thing, not even just musicians. But it's hard to sometimes hear the commitment to your own voice, your own practice, and to really be able to, like, let those other pressures go when you're actually creating.
I mean, there's not really an easy answer to that. Obviously, you know, I listen to a lot of music. Some of what's happening finds its way into what I'm doing, but, you know, one of the challenges has been that not jumping onto what's happening at the moment has definitely reflected itself in my numbers. I've never, you know, I am 15 years in. I've never quite had that break into a more popular consciousness, whereas a lot of other artists that started at the same time are doing exceptionally well as far as finances are concerned. For me, it really just comes down to, it's not fun for me if I'm trying to do what other people are doing. And it's that simple. Like, I write the music that I want to write, that feels good to me, and whenever I've attempted to make something, relevant is not the word, whenever I've tried to make something that sounds like what it's supposed to sound like this week, it just doesn't feel, it's not fun. It doesn't feel good.
Yeah, I can hear. I mean, that's one of the things. I mean, being able to, you know, have touched base with you off and on over many years, that was one of the things that I was always struck by with you, is that even when you were sort of, you know, on the ascent, you know, like, here it comes, you know, the big things are just about to happen, that I could tell that you were always also just as much, if not more concerned with your own, with living well, with having a balanced life, with having a place that you could call home, with making music that was really personal to you and not just, you know, riding this thing. And I think it's so easy, especially for young people, to just, like, not even be able to begin to develop those inner desires for a balanced life, or for a more intimate life, or for a more sort of true to the self way of creating things. And so it's really interesting to hear you talk that way, and also to see how you have continued to, you know, keep it together, as they say, not following these kinds of larger trends. Do you, when since you also, you know, meet a lot of musicians, including a lot of younger musicians, is this something you've noticed, that it seems like it's hard for people, even when they have a really unique voice, to kind of not lose themselves too quickly to the heat of the moment and the possibilities and the financial possibilities and all that?
I think there's as many answers to that question as there are people to ask them. You know, each artist has their own particular arc. For me, particularly, I've been kind of going for the long play. You know, I want to make music that the people who actually pick up on are still listening to in 10 and 20 years. Not, oh, that record's dated, you know, it was really good in 2005, but it doesn't hold up anymore. And I actually spent this last week going back and listening to some of the classic early 90s ambient that you were waxing poetic about, and the stuff that moved me back then still moves me. It still holds up. Higher Intelligence Agency, Global Communication, Irresistible Force, all that early stuff still sounds great. It still holds its own, and that's kind of the target that I set for myself. I want to look back at my life and my career and be proud of the music that I made during each particular phase of my life, and not feel that I was trying to play to what was happening that year, you know?
Yeah, no, I totally, I mean, I've had my own version of that is, my book Technosis, which came out in 1998, like it went out of print finally last year, which is quite a long run for a book, especially a somewhat esoteric book. And someone wants to put it out again, so that's really cool. So I've been sort of going over it again, and it was a very similar experience in the sense that, you know, writing a book about, you know, technology and spirituality in the late 90s during the first internet bubble, you know, you could just carpet your apartment with dollar bills if you did that in a certain way. And I didn't do it that way. I did it in this much weirder way. But the funny thing is it still holds up. Even though it was written at that time, it's like it's not really dated. I mean, I get some things wrong. I don't see some things coming down the pike. Obviously, it's of its era, too. But it's not dated in that way, and that's why people keep coming back to it. And so it's sort of, for me, and also when it came out, like, it hardly got reviewed. People didn't really know what to do with it. But it was on that slow and steady kind of pace where the people who needed to read it found it, and it spread more like a mushroom than a, you know, rocket ship. And you know, so it ended up having this kind of momentum, which it, for me, ended up being reflected in my life as well, that, like, I'm also kind of on the long haul zone where, like, I can look back, and even though I've done some goofy stuff, or, you know, I've written, you know, articles for TV Guide and all this kind of stuff, that almost everything I've done, I did because it was interesting to me at the time, and not because it was the most canny or was going to get me up the ladder or things like that. And, you know, sometimes that I could, you know, have a little sadness about that. I see what happens to other people's careers, and, you know, money's nice on some level, but overall, I'm very happy.
You definitely go through that process in the brain, like, what if I made something specifically to capture this market? But like I said, it's no fun. I've tried. It just doesn't feel right.
I want to know more about what your latest release is like, because I know you have, it's Space Op Chronicles Part 1, and there's multi parts. It's an EP. And so is this kind of like an epic story that's going to unfold over multiple releases? I'd love to hear about that, and then also just the way that you use Kickstarter to make it happen, and you know, a really positive example of how the new conditions can help musicians, you know, pursue their own visions and not just ape the trends.
So Space Hop Chronicles is an attempt for me to kind of return to the lost art of the album. And it came from my love of intelligent sci-fi and graphic novels, you know, soaking in a lot of, like, 60s and 70s classic sci-fi covers, serialized narrative in the form of graphic novel, and I begin thinking about, you know, the concept album. And instead of doing this huge bloated 2-CD release, I thought releasing it in a serialized format, kind of like a graphic novel, where you get a piece of the narrative, but actually build some anticipation for the next piece, I thought would be a really fun idea. So instead of putting it, you know, spending the time to make this whole 2-volume, 3-volume, 4-volume, whatever it ends up being, reality, I want it to be like a graphic novel. So I put this first volume out with the kind of introduction to the story arc that's going to carry it through. And, you know, I don't need to talk about the current state of the music industry. Most people are pretty aware of how things are going. Labels are really not cutting the mustard anymore. And for me, the Kickstarter kind of arose out of necessity. I didn't have the capital to print vinyl and do the things I wanted to do with the custom posters and all that kind of stuff. So I thought I would give my fans the opportunity to act as the record label. And, you know, I believed that there was support there if I just asked for it, and was well rewarded, actually, from fans kind of getting behind the concept and being excited about it and willing to financially support seeing the project.
So was your campaign for the whole run of the releases?
No, it was just for the first volume, actually.
Right. And then I've only heard the music. I don't have it in a physical copy. Is there a story that's printed? Are you writing an explicit tale, or is the story kind of motivating it more inside and more suggestively?
Our good friend Eve Lady Apples is actually writing the narrative, and the story arc is an alternative history of Laika the space dog. So instead of Laika going up and dying in space in this craft, we're telling an alternative history where Laika, we don't even know, it's story unfolding, but Laika perhaps goes to other dimensions, begins to travel through time. I mean, that's part of the joy of this, is that it's an ongoing dialogue with Eve about what happens next. The first volume is kind of the introduction of this first-person narrative of, like, orbiting Earth in this spacecraft for the first time. So
that's great. No, it's a wonderful setup and a great collaboration as well. We've had Eve on Expanding Mind a couple of years ago. It was a great talk, and it's also fun to have sort of the music without lyrics as a way of holding a story. It's a really interesting mode, because it's sort of like, in that way, it's kind of like a graphic novel, in the sense that, yes, a graphic novel is telling a story. There's, you know, word balloons, and you're reading a story at the same time. But the way that the graphics function in relationship to the story is very atmospheric. It's very, you know, multidimensional, emotional. And so in a lot of ways, it's like the music is taking the place of the imagery in a graphic novel. So I think it's a really cool idea, and it really comes, you know, it comes through even just on the cover and the way the kind of music flows. You know, there's always been a sort of narrative sense to your music, like there is a kind of evolution of feelings and events that's happening. One question is this thing about the Laika that makes me want to ask about animals. For some reason, I'm really interested in, like, your own experience of animals, of dogs in particular, as being really, you know, in significant parts of your life, of your way that you've navigated the world, your own emotions, your own sense of relationship. So what is it about the dog that attracted you?
I mean, it's kind of funny, the Laika thing came about not specifically because of, you know, my long relationship with dogs as pets, and the animal house has definitely expanded here. There's now two parrots, one of whom is singing songs in the background. I don't know if it'll come through on the recording or not. The Laika piece, I was kind of soaking in this aesthetic universe of, like I said, late 60s, 70s, kind of sci-fi book covers, and loving, you know, the most exciting thing to me is not the original cover, but when you find it at a used bookstore and the cover's kind of frayed and it has this natural decay and antiquing to it, there's something really attractive to me about that aesthetic. So I was thinking, I had been on the road supporting a previous album and was kind of thinking about dirtying up the composition and exploring more analog synthesis, you know, with its natural detunings and imperfections that occur there. And I sat down to write the first piece of this record, and I just, Laika popped into my head. Like, I didn't even know too much about the story of Laika, and just created this piece about Laika. And after I finished the piece, I went and did research about Laika, and I finished the piece on the anniversary of Laika's death and launch into space. And it was this really kind of, you know, wow kind of moment. Like, I felt like I'd tapped into a narrative story and realize that there's this huge kind of cult following for Laika, and, you know, graphic novels that have been written and studios called Laika, and a whole kind of generation of people that are inspired by that story. And I felt like I had tapped into that by accident. It somehow just happened. And the thinking about that story actually informed the rest of the composition, and it allowed me to try some odd things and go for kind of obtuse, non-resolving harmonic progressions that captured that sense of weightless wonder as this animal is floating in space. And it just, all the lines kind of converged at the same point in time and made a lot of sense. It wasn't necessarily this logical, like, oh, I love dogs, I want to, you know, do something that honors the spirit of this animal. It just kind of happened, but it made perfect sense, like it was supposed to happen.
No, it's wonderful stuff. And there's also something really poetic in a way that I can't quite unpack about animals in space. There's something like extra, both sort of poetic and bizarre and right. I mean, there's some very powerful resonance there that I'm not even sure where to go with. But we're going to have to take a break right now. You're listening to Expanding Mind with Eric Davis. We're talking with Evan Bartholomew about his music as Blue Tech, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Expanding Mind on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm Eric Davis, and we're talking with Evan Bartholomew. What can you just? Well, I just want to ask a little bit more about the Space Hop Chronicles and your ongoing saga of Laika. What do we find out in the first episode? If people grab the EP and listen to it, what's unfolding in her experiences there?
So the Bandcamp page actually has the introductory text. Unfortunately, iTunes doesn't include that, but the physical, the vinyl and the CD actually have that first narrative printed on there, and it would be a disservice of me to try to summarize that too much, because it's a piece that you've put a lot of work into. But the introductory scene, if this were a graphic novel, we don't do backstory. It kind of begins with orbiting Earth in a spacecraft and thinking about the reality of humans who are supposed to be the masters of dogs, sending a dog into space for the first time to kind of test out space exploration and see if it is going to be safe for humans. And there's definitely a bit of melancholy and a bit of the natural world responding to the dominance of man in that introductory narrative.
Sweet. Well, so what's the URL for that?
Bluetech.bandcamp.com, and on the album description page, there's the first poem printed, or the first piece, I guess.
Great. Well, what I want to stay with a little bit is that melancholy. I mean, it's something that a lot of people feel on all sorts of levels. I think a lot of animals feel it, too. I think a lot of plants feel it, too. And it's something that's really, I think one of the great challenges of where we are, I mean, on top of all the quote-unquote things to do, demands, actions, activism, all that, there's also a sort of emotional reckoning that we all have to go through, that even in the best, most amazing, most magical scenarios that we could possibly imagine of what actually happens on the planet at this point in history, there's still this extraordinary loss, extraordinary, painful, ripping sense of loss of species, loss of extraordinary wild places, the dominance of the crappiest of humankind's manifestations on the material plane. And it's, some can be overwhelming. It can be, despairing. It can be, this the sort of sense of hopelessness. And one of the things that I've heard in your music, but I also see in the work that you're doing outside of music and the activist work you're doing and the work online with Nomad Cultures, other things that we can talk about, that you're refusing that to both deny the melancholy and deny the great sadness, but also you're turning away from the kind of quietism that people can get into. Oh, there's nothing I can do. There's nothing to, oh, what are we going to do? Okay, well, let's just go to another party and da da da. You're definitely not pulling that way. So I just, to shift a little bit away from the music, just to hear a little bit about you and how you've come to hear that call, hear that melancholy, and then have a craft a response that's, definitely, making a mark that's heard out there.
I mean, I think that if your eyes are open, the grief is inescapable. And the reality of the situation in which we find ourselves is that most people do not have the tools, are not culturally prepared to be able to deal with grief as a constant reality of life. For me, I'm not, as you said, I'm not going to turn away from that grief. And when you begin to actually come to terms with that and have an emotional reckoning about the situation in which we find ourselves in modern society, the only possible response is one of action. And I found that a lot of that action kind of reinforces the doom and gloom response for people and maybe makes them unable to respond. Oh my God, Amazon is almost gone. This is happening. The polar ice caps are melting. There's nothing I can do. I'm going to go bury my head under a pillow. A lot of the ecological narrative supports that. And so my response was to find a way to give people an option to act that didn't have to reinforce that doom and gloom depression. Depression is somebody's going to smack me for saying this, but in a situation like this, depression is a kind of a coward's response. It's an inability to metabolize grief and actually do something with it. So for me, art, using art for change, using art as a fundraising tool or an awareness-raising tool, doesn't have to be, oh my God, we're all going to die. It can be fun. It can be celebratory. Like, cool, this is a situation in which we find ourselves. Now let's try to make something beautiful from the ashes of the situation. And for me, it was the only way to keep the depression at bay, but still experience the beauty of grieving in a truly deep way about where we are as a species on this planet, and still be motivated to try to make something beautiful and inspire people to open their eyes and look around them and engage in the experience instead of sit back and allow it to continue on in the way that it's been.
Yeah, I mean, I know you have a number of different projects that you're sort of doing along these lines, but I'd just love to hear how that evolved. What was the first real step forward towards bringing your music and your aesthetic into activism? Was it Critical Beats, or how did you find the way to manifest this more active spirit in relationship?
It's a constant challenging. I think what happened for me is really this experience of living in Hawaii and truly falling in love in a mystical way with the natural world, and started collecting plants, rare plants from the Amazon, and kept finding, I'd get a plant from somebody and they would tell me, like, oh, this is extinct in the wild. There's, four people on the planet that have this particular plant. And it really opened my eyes to kind of the situation around the type of plants that I was collecting. And Jeremy and Sheena, who started Critical Beats, had come to visit me in Hawaii when they were on their way down to the Amazon for the first time to work with an indigenous community down there. And the disparity between falling in love with the natural world and constantly burning fossil fuels on a plane from city to city to city just got too intense for me to deal with without some type of response, and I had previously had contact with them and knew that they were working on a project. So the first response, I guess, was the Rainforest Reverberation album, which was 100% of all funds donated to the Critical Beats Project and the initiatives that they had in Ecuador.
And how did that album work musically? You took sounds from indigenous groups and from the jungle and mixed them together, or how did that evolve? How did the making of the music reflect the intent of the project?
On that particular release, I had not had access to any of the field recordings they had done yet. It was just me in a studio writing something that I knew was not for building my hype and increasing my booking revenue for the year and, you know, getting a single and satisfying a label. It was just writing music and putting stuff together that I knew was going toward a particular project.
And then have you done other stuff that has been using samples from the Amazon?
I haven't, and the delicacy for me is not only that I feel a lot is lost in translation, but kind of respecting the integrity, the holistic integrity of an indigenous tradition, and not cheapening it or trying to overlay it on a Western digital mindset, and you know, that's a personal aesthetic choice for me. I know a lot of people feel differently.
No, I'm actually really happy to hear you say that. I mean, that was probably why I was pressing on those lines, just to hear how you kind of navigated that, because, you know, if you're a white American dealing with this, even if you're totally falling in love and you're being as respectful as you can, that issue of appropriation, the issue of respect, the issue of behaving appropriately, and it's kind of funny, appropriation and appropriate are so close, that of behaving appropriately in relationship to these cultures and their expression is a very, very significant one, and it's one that I find sadly mangled in a great deal of, let's call it neo-tribal culture or festival culture. You know, among people who, if you actually talk to them, you know, might have their heart in the right place and even sort of, you know, be involved on some level or another. For me, there was a shocking experience at this one gathering where there was a bunch of sellers, market folks, and I walked in and I just didn't really notice what the shop was like, and I just went, and they had some Shipibo cloth, and it was just a simple piece of, and it was clearly had been done for an export market. It had a kind of glossy quality, but you know, it was just a simple cloth, and I went, oh, this is going to be a beautiful altar cloth that I can afford. And so I was really happy to have found this one piece and this one pattern. And then I looked around me and I realized that same pattern was, you know, used throughout the store and all these like sexy little hot pants and everything. And I was just like, oh man, you know, did you guys have to be so bold? And you know, you talk to the people and they're like, yeah, and the, you know, some percentage goes back to the people who are making it, da da da. And so, you know, maybe that's an okay solution. I don't have a huge judgment against it, but I do feel like there's a sort of a challenge there for a lot of people or for the culture as a whole that really hasn't been dealt with appropriately. I mean, I'd love to hear your reflections on it, because I know you think really long and hard about this stuff, and you also see a lot of things. So,
I mean, that particular story, you know, unfortunately, a lot of the Shipibo designs you see at festivals are borrowed designs that are then manufactured in Bali at sub-minimum wages and sold for exceptionally high retail prices to people that come to music festivals. And I think one of the big challenges, and this has been a constant challenge with all the work that I do, is the fact that colonialism is inherently built into not only our language, but our culture. You know, from the myth of the noble savage to, there's so many ways in just our cognition, our perception of the world is colonial in nature. And I've definitely had my butt handed to me on a platter when working with indigenous communities about even the path of approach and the language used, and even the most altruistic of activists often falls into colonial language when they're quote unquote helping the savages. And you know, it's a it's a dialogue that is not popular whenever I begin to have it, especially in festival culture, but it's one that I think needs to be addressed.
It's a real conundrum. The way that I experience it, and I have not gone out of my way to have much direct contact with indigenous communities, though I do read a lot of anthropology and indigenous accounts that are more intellectual or philosophically framed. So I'm familiar with a lot of the discourse around these issues. And the conundrum I see is that the only real way, because it both, you know, there's the you know, the, because we have the noble savage, it means that even your most open-hearted, engaged, positive views are invariably coming from this colonialist background. That the only way to really go forward from that is to have direct engagement, to go there, get your ass kicked, develop a dialogue,
practice, which is a hands-off, observe from a colonial perspective,
right.
Whether anthropology will acknowledge that it's coming from that perspective. You know, when you are coming from a culture which is an individualist culture, quote-unquote, observing a culture which doesn't even have the verb to be, they define themselves in relationship to their surroundings and how they fit in the flux of connected things. Unless you are immersed, there's no way really to escape the colonial mind unless you completely engage and have contact and sit and share story with people living in a completely different frame of mind.
Yeah, but I still think there's a space for somewhere where you'll never be totally immersed, and even if you say what would you be immersed in, that in these situations, there's lots of variance on their side too. There are some people who are totally hewing a deeply traditional line, and then there's all sorts of characters who are riding the edge too and finding their ways to communicate, you know, out into the world. And while a lot of anthropology is totally screwed, especially historically, there are veins of it now where people are raising precisely the questions you're asking, where they're at, like, how do you actually do that? And some indigenous, you know, intellectuals then use those languages as well and try to work something out. So there are zones, at least for me, and maybe I'm just deluded, but there are zones for me that
I actually think that finally academia is beginning to approach, and maybe it's based on the sheer fact of cultures disappearing, the last few intact indigenous cultures, like, on the verge of extinction, that Western anthropology, or anthropology in general, is really beginning to approach from a different perspective.
I hope so. But anyway, so that's the conundrum I'm bringing to you, is that unless you physically, personally go and really commit to working through all this crap, that it's like you say, it's sort of impossible to do. So when you have a larger culture, like something like festival culture, or people who are trying to, work for indigenous rights and da-da-da, and a lot of people, you need a lot of people to be doing that, but you can't have them all go down and share story. That's just going to overwhelm the situation,
It's not possible.
How do we develop a way of thinking about it? Maybe there's no answer to it, but I know you've thought about this a lot, and you've made the decision to not just be somebody who looks at this from afar, maybe with romantic ideas, but to go there, go to the Amazon, make connections, share story, all that kind of thing. How have you come to feel about the best way for the larger culture who has this attraction, who wants these people to flourish as much as possible, to not fall into these same colonialist traps? Is there any way?
It's an ongoing process for sure. I mean, when I talked about removing the doom and gloom, I recognize that I'm one of, one in probably 100,000 people that is able to go to the Amazon and work with an indigenous community, and even locally work with indigenous communities. I'm not trying to get everyone to go have an indigenous experience. I think that that's actually counterproductive and would cause a lot of problems. You know, we can talk about ayahuasca tourism in South America is one of the problematic situations that has arisen from everyone running to have an indigenous experience. What my response was, make it fun, approach people where they're at, and the first hurdle I think that needs to be addressed is the feeling of helplessness and the depression about the state of the situation. So my work with Critical Beats, the projects that I'm working on now, are really about, here's art that you already like, here's something that you're already into, you get to support it, and it gets to support something bigger than yourself, and allow people a sense of ownership and contribution, which at least gets them out of a feeling of helplessness and provides resources for people that are on the ground and are able to go and have those meetings and have those dialogues to be able to do the work that they want to do.
Yeah, that's great. Well, and then another aspect of that work for you, I can only imagine, is nomad culture. Tell me a little bit about this website, magazine. What's the idea there? How did that get started?
So that got started because I made a very realistic post about the Basement Dubs album and just said, hey, cool, look, you know, there's, at that point, I think there was 30,000 people on my Facebook page. Like, okay, 30,000 people on the Facebook page. This is how many hours I put into this particular album. This is how many years I've been studying music and doing music. And I posted the actual sales numbers, which was like very low, much, much less than 1%. And was hit by a barrage of exceptionally negative feedback from people about how I should quit whining and get a day job and I just need a tour. So I made a second post of, okay, here's the actual reality of what it means to be a musician in this day and age. And I kind of broke it down, the struggles, the fact that people will pay $5 for a latte and $5 for a beer at the bar that they enjoy for approximately 15 minutes, yet won't drop $5 for an album that is their soundtrack for the year or for the next 10 years. And it went viral really, really quickly and got a lot of different response from musicians in similar situations. And it got me thinking about how to be effective in my goal of not just being an artist, but being someone who encourages and inspires dialogue and communication and growth in my community. And talked to my friend Lily at Harvard, who has been struggling with a lot of these same issues, figuring out where she wants to publish, not sure that publishing in academic journals is really the best route for her. And we kind of just backstage in one of my shows in Boston had a pinky promise that we were going to create a platform to feature artists, musicians, activists, intellectuals, thinkers, academics, a place for them to publish that was more of a pop format, you know. Again, continuing with this theme of making activism accessible by not making it dry and doom and gloom, but celebrating people that are actually doing work and in whatever format that is. So Nomad Culture is an attempt to make an online tapestry of culture, of people, whatever it is, you know, activism through hip-hop, working with indigenous communities, making art that matters, you know, just kind of make the net, make the focus much larger and inclusive and get away from the doom and gloom and shine a light on positive change, positive action. Positive
you know, it's amazing, and I mean, this is it's sad to say when you know, when I hear you talk and when I see, you know, read through some of the articles on the site, I was thinking about, I was listening to Alain de Botton on the radio the other day, and he has a new book about the news, and he's very critical of certain aspects of the news. And, you know, one of the things he said was, you know, he says, look, I think the news, what it should do is to help societies flourish. And if some of that involves, you know, the critical attack on things that are going wrong, or the revelation of you know, dark truths about an industry or about a politician, that's great. But it needs to be balanced with stories that help people flourish, that remind people that things can happen, that positive things can happen, that connections can be made, that people can manifest their dreams. And I remember sitting there listening to it and going, and I had this really like cynical response, like almost like a reactive response. I was like, oh God, that's just crazy. That's not what the news is. And then right after that, I was like, oh my God, I can't believe that, like, even me has internalized this idea that what we're supposed to read about the real world is this steady diet of grim, gloom, doom, attack, cynical, mm-hmm. blah, 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 and that it's very hard to carve out a space for stories that are positive but still grounded in reality. So it's it's good work. But it's tough too. It's really tough. It's amazing how much we're addicted to the doom and gloom, as you put it. You know,
well,
on top of the fact that
it's a response not only to the predominant narrative of mass media, which is doom and gloom, but also a response to the oversimplified romantic new ageisms that we were seeing on a lot of popular websites that are, in my opinion, often causing as much harm by not being balanced. Like, having a discerning, critical approach to issues is really important. Not, oh my God, look, beautiful Shipibo designs on your underwear, but actually looking at, like, okay, those designs are beautiful, but there's a deeper story, and let's actually talk about what that means, what that looks like to borrow a design from another culture. Doesn't have to be doom and gloom, doesn't have to be negative and heavy-handed, but we wanted to provide a more critical thinking-based reflection of both some of the beautiful things that are happening in culture and some of the problematic areas in which new culture is picking and choosing the pieces that they want from indigenous communities.
Yeah, that's just really beautiful. I want so much more of that. I mean, it's a tough path, but it's got to happen. This sort of balance of criticality and heart, you know, and you got to have both elements. And if you just have one or the other, you know, if you just have the heart, you're going to waltz into delusion. If you just have criticality, then you're dealing with that despair and depression that we talked about, or shame even. And it's that fine line between the two that really needs to come through. And, you know, kudos to you for trying that on top of all the other stuff, that you're doing. And we just got a minute here left. Maybe that's the question. You're involved with a lot of stuff and a lot of heavy stuff, as well as a lot of really creative, expanded thing. What's the source that lets you keep doing that? We got a minute here. So just like, what do you attribute that to?
Just simply, I'm in love with the world. You know, it has all the challenges of being in a love relationship, being hurt, being inspired, being like tragically crushed by beauty, and the only way that I see how to live my life is to respond.
Well, that's beautiful, man. I thank you for your words and for giving us your time. I really appreciate you being on the show.
Awesome. Thanks so much, Eric.
All right, and you can find out more Blue Tech online and check out Nomad Culture as well, and you can go give a listen to Space Hop Chronicles, which I really recommend. I'm looking forward to the rest of the series. So from me to all you out there, keep your minds open.